An evening with Emma Bovary. I'd never met her, of course, but I knew her well. Better than she knew herself, really. In a way, it would have been easy to fool her. I'd read so many times about her excursions on horseback with Rodolphe, her whispered conversations with the clerk Léon, and their frantic carriage ride round and round the streets of Rouen, during which the only sign that there was anyone in the cab came when a hand emerged to throw away the torn-up fragments of the letter she'd written to say she couldn't be his mistress. Again and again I'd read of her extravagance, her yearnings, the sad unreality of her romantic conviction that, as the novel she read told her, she could find and keep that one great love that would lift her out of all the dreariness of provincial France. Of me, she knew nothing. I'd sent her a note telling her I was a writer researching a novel set in Normandy and wanted to talk with someone educated, refined, with an artistic sensibility, who might offer the sort of insights I needed. My real motive was just to meet her, and so, yes, I was fooling her. That's why, to use one of the clichés which she always seemed to fall for, I gilded the lily. I also reassured her that our conversation would be in French and that we'd have dinner in the basement of Le Garrick in Soho, where tables are set discreetly in alcoves, and the only evidence of other diners is the gentle susurration of exchanged confidences. In the taxi on the way there, she was transfixed by the sights we passed, the monuments, the people, the vibrancy of London at night. The questions tumbled from her, and the years fell away to reveal the beautiful young girl who had agreed to marry poor, dull Charles after his visits to her father's farm. It was fascinating to see a woman who'd lived through so much deception, so many disappointments and crushed dreams, throw them all off and start believing yet again that there were still adventures waiting for her, loves and passions to experience. She thanked me for giving her the chance to see it all. She'd never been so overwhelmed by anything in her poor provincial life. It even eclipsed the ball to which she and Charles had been invited at La Vaubyessard. I recognised the signs. It would be so easy to use words, glances, innuendos to draw her attention to me, to my exoticism as a foreigner. And as a writer, too, an artist. Her experience had been only with Frenchmen, a provincial doctor, a lawyer's clerk, a pretend nobleman. My accent, my restraint, yes, my obvious respect for her, were all new. "Do you mind if I make a personal comment?" I said. "Of course not." "Well, I was just thinking, this particular ride is very different from the one you took with Léon in Rouen, isn't it?" She turned quickly to look at me, a slightly panicked expression on her face. "I thought that charming," I added quickly. She blushed. "No, it was foolish. He was a boy, clumsy, with a boy's appetites. His words were empty."
"And yet you spent time with him after that. He became..."
She shook her head. "No. Well, perhaps at the time, but I'm wiser now. I can see how foolish I was to be drawn by his words. I was a dreamer." The look on her face as she spoke suggested that she would still find such dreams appealing.
"We all have dreams," I said. "Each time I read about you..."
"Each time," she said, her eyebrows raised and a smile on those gorgeous lips.
"Oh, yes. I've read Monsieur Flaubert's account many times. And each time, forgive me, but each time I wanted to warn you not to believe Rodolphe, to see Léon for the awkward, unworthy person he was. I wanted to tell you that you were right. You were superior to all those pathetic men who surrounded you, that you did deserve better." A shiver went through me as she raised a hand and touched it to my lips.
"Shh," she said. "I know. I knew it then, and I know it now. Do you really think I was impressed when Leon, that boy, said all that stupid nonsense about some famous musician who, when he wanted inspiration, would go and play his piano amongst spectacular scenery? I mean, how do you get a piano up the Matterhorn? No, I was just playing his game. I admit that I wanted it all to be true, but I knew it wasn't. There's been too much evidence in my life that we're all absurd. All we can do is catch the moments as they pass." And so the tone for the evening was set. At the restaurant, we reminisced about her adventures, the people, the happy times and the sad ones, her daughter, her dog, the beautiful bitterness of her response to the lawyer who'd made advances to her when she went to ask him for a loan. "I'm to be pitied, not sold." She nodded at this point. "Yes, I played all my parts to perfection, I think." And I had to agree with her. Every word she'd said showed me that all along she knew what she was doing, knew that Rodolphe and the rest were driven by hungers, and that for all their talk of feelings, love, aching souls, their goals were purely physical. She knew it, played along with it, and by her life proved the broken nature of the reality we all live. I thought I knew her, but I was wrong. She was even greater than I'd imagined. At the end of the evening, as we sipped Calvados, I asked the sort of question which showed how banal I'd become in her presence. "So, if you had it all over again, what would you change?" She shook her head. "Nothing," she said. Oh, there were tears, but there was also ecstasy. They didn't feel it, but I did. I lived outside the limits society tried to impose. She smiled. Then her expression changed. "Wait, though. Yes, I would change one thing." "What?" I asked. "The suicide was stupid. Painful, too, but mainly stupid. It's no answer. Life was my passion. Life is everything." We took a cab back through streets still buzzing with excitement, and since kissing her lips would have been a sacrilege, I kissed her hand and left her at her hotel. As I walked back through the crowds, I knew that I was even more in love with her than I had been before.